Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, a regional West African court tells Sierra Leone that a law targeting young, poor, and mostly women should be scrapped.
Can you imagine, you know, being stopped and asked to give a good and satisfactory account of yourself? You're going about your business. Those who have been disproportionately the target of arrest for loitering are persons of lower economic means and women. And police will round them up and then force them either to pay bribes or have non-consensual sex.
An investigation into the serious health problems people who live near oil wells in South Sudan are suffering.
When floods came to our area, water mixed with the chemical waste, and we started seeing babies born with no eyes.
And what's behind the dispute over whether or not a French company will withdraw from uranium production in Niger? It's Monday, the 11th of November. First, we go to Freetown. The government of Sierra Leone is on notice to change a law that campaigners say targets young people, especially young women. The legislation the law is based on dates back to the colonial era, and it authorizes police to arrest and charge anyone deemed to be idle in a public place at night. We'll hear more about the background to the case and the campaign to get it scrapped from a friend of the podcast, Umaru Fofana, in Freetown. But here is Justice Edward Amwaka Asante handing down the decision by the Court of the Economic Community of West African States, a regional court with jurisdiction over member states.
It is clear that the country, as a matter of urgency, must take steps to either repeal the law or amend it in terms of its international obligations under Article 1 of the African Charter and all the other appropriate.
That's the judge there, Justice Edward Amwaka Asante, Judge Rapporteur of the ECOWAS Court, and reading out this, I think, Umaru Fofana in Freetown. Quite historic judgment, because loitering laws are laws that we find on the books of very, very many African countries, not just in West Africa, but across the continent. And they're quite old laws, and sometimes they adopted, you know, whole scale from the colonial era. Give us the context of these laws in Sierra Leone.
Yes, Audrey, you are right. And it is in that regard that the wording of one of the loitering laws, namely the Public Order Act of 1965, for example, Audrey, is pretty vague. And this is something which the court said, and I'll just read you part of it. It says, any person loitering in or about any stable house or building under any piazza or in the open air and not having any visible means of subsistence and not giving a good account of himself shall be deemed an idle and disorderly person and shall, on conviction thereof, be liable to imprisonment, unquote. So effectively, Audrey, this makes it a crime to stand, walk, or even be in a public place, some say even in front of your house, without a clear reason as determined by the law enforcement authorities. I mean, this is what the court contends is anachronistic, and ordered that the country, you know, should take immediate steps to repeal the provisions. For a bit of context, some scholars say the colonial administration, which had this provision in the Summary Conviction Offences Ordinance of 1905, was paranoid, so they sought to restrict or even cow the locals. And even after independence in 1965, there was a law that was promulgated, which basically retained some of those provisions, and that's the Public Order Act.
So how widespread was the enforcement of the loitering laws, and who were the people that were most affected by it?
Well, it has been. It still is really widespread. I mean, its enforcement, because it's still in the law books. Police cells have been sometimes overcrowded with people arrested in poor neighborhoods under the loitering provisions. Many are brought before the courts and tried and subsequently imprisoned. Others just, disappear after compromising the police. So it is widely used and widely abused.
The organization Advocate brought this case. What were they responding to? And have we heard from them their reaction on the ruling by the ECOWAS court?
Advocate have been really chuffed. They've been really excited by this. And so are many other rights groups, not least because they say this law targets poor people, even hawkers, street traders who do their business late at night have been a target of the enforcement of these provisions by the law enforcement authorities here, especially the police. Elena Thompson, the legal counsel who represented the litigants, the women's rights group advocate, gave me their reaction to the court ruling.
The ECOWAS court judgment really sends a strong message to Sierra Leone and to states across West Africa and beyond that laws must be crafted, must be developed to protect rather than abuse the rights and dignity of the poor and the most vulnerable. We've seen that those who have been disproportionately the target of arrest for loitering are persons of lower economic means and women. And police conduct raids into those areas. We'll round them up, detain them, and then force them either to pay bribes or have non-consensual sex with police officers in order to be released. These persons were deliberately exploited and targeted by the police because of their social status and because the police know that they can take advantage of the poor.
That's Elena Thompson from Advocate there. Umaru, she gives a very clear account of the kinds of people that are targeted by this law. It's been going on for a very long time. Has the government of Sierra Leone said anything about it?
Yes, the government has reacted by saying that it does agree that poverty and status should not be criminalized, as the loitering laws are seen by many to do. And that, in fact, it has been working in recent months, it says, to ensure that the prisons are reserved for the most serious offenses. Alpha Cissé is the country's Deputy Minister of Justice and a longtime rights campaigner himself.
The ruling itself doesn't change much because the need to decriminalize petty offenses or repeal loitering laws in Sierra Leone is actually part of government's reform policy. So we have been in discussions with several actors across the justice sector. That includes police. We are putting together a reform package, which will be in the form of legislation that goes to parliament. Having a moratorium in place, you know, even before we table legislation in parliament, is part of the options that we have discussed as a government.
That's Alpha Cissé, who's Sierra Leone's Deputy Minister of Justice. Umaru, what's been the public reaction to the ECOWAS court ruling?
Audrey, you know, as a football fan, I watched part of the Chelsea-Arsenal match yesterday in a crowded public place, and I engaged some young people afterwards. None of them had anything good to say about the loitering laws, and they look forward to, I mean, their repeal. One even told me that he and many other revelers sometimes think twice, you know, before returning home to a poor neighborhood at Kisii in the east of Freetown after going clubbing. He says he often spends the night at the club for fear of being arrested by the police. So it's clear and present danger. Somebody said it's like a Damocles hanging over the heads of particularly young people who go out as revelers at night or even who do their businesses, you know, one way or the other. And on social media, there has been so much condemnation. People have been condemnatory of the laws and commending the ECOWAS courts for the judgments. They can't wait for these laws to be repealed.
And do people trust that actually the police will stop harassing people immediately and that the law will eventually become part of Sierra Leone's bag of legal tricks?
Well, if clearly there is no moratorium officially announced by the state, then the police will definitely continue enforcing these laws. But if there is a moratorium announced by the state, I would imagine that, yes, the information will be percolated down to the lower level of the police officers, in which case they will not arrest people under the loitering laws. In terms of how soon this will be promulgated, the government will have to read them by what they say. They really say that they are committed and this reform has been launched. It is the hope of many here that eventually that will be tabled in parliament for particularly these laws, the petty offences laws, as they are called, are repealed.
Thank you so much. We'll keep an eye on this.
You're welcome, Audrey. Cheers.
That's Umaru Fofana in Freetown. Parts of South Sudan have been flooded, causing hundreds of thousands of families to lose their homes. The extreme flooding began following heavy rains in 2019, and at its peak 2 years ago, up to 70% of Unity State in the north was underwater. More than 700,000 people have been affected across the country. And now, a BBC Africa Eye investigation has revealed that oil pollution is making matters worse. The area has been drilled for oil for decades, and the water has been contaminated. And now there are reports that it's making people sick. There are also reports of serious birth defects, which are being linked to the contaminated water. We'll be hearing if this is indeed the case with the Africa Eye reporter Maura Ajak, who investigated the claims when she visited the area.
I traveled to Unity State. I visited in particular the northern part of the state bordering South Sudan. It's called Roriak. The whole area is submerged with floods, and also the livelihoods, it's quite dire. And I've seen a lot of displaced persons due to floods, and they are migrating towards the northern part of the state because it's a higher ground surrounded by water dikes. Most of them, they don't have any shelter, but they're sheltering themselves next to the oil wells. And it's really quite risky because they are vulnerable, and then most of them, they lack knowledge about the danger or the risks of sheltering next to the oil wells.
Do they have any choice, though, I'm wondering? And did you see any signs of environmental damage or pollution around the oil drilling sites where people were living?
Honestly, through my interaction with them and then going with the chief of the community, Chief Chilhokpot, he talked a lot about the risks and then lack of availability of some resources and some other stuff, basic needs. He said that there is no any other choice because it's the only dry or higher ground where people can move away from the other flooded sites. The other thing is the damage that's been happening over that site. They have food insecurity, honestly, and then biodiversity loss. The floods also damage livestock because I found a lot of bones of cows or cattle. The other thing also, irregular cutting of trees in the forest. Most of them, they're relying on burning charcoal. We met Nyataba Biar. She's the head of a family of 10. They were burning charcoal next to the oil wells, and they're living in plastic sheets. I've asked her if they have any other choice, and she said there is no any choice because it's the only dry higher ground. Nyataba Biar talked about the issue of water, that they're drinking contaminated water from the oil exploration because they are thirsty. She said they don't have any other alternative.
We know it's bad water, but we don't have anywhere else. We are dying of thirst. The water makes us cough. If you drink it, it makes you pant and cough.
That's Nyataba Biar. Maura, did people talk to you about specific unusual health issues that they've faced as well? She says that it made them cough. Did they tell you anything else?
There are a lot of health issues that they've been facing, and one of them said that apart from coughing, it's causing also diarrhea for 7 days if you didn't get any medication or access to health facility. From my conversation with Chief Chilhokpot, he talked more about the effects that women are facing, especially birth defects on babies.
When floods came to our area, water mixed with the chemical waste, and we started seeing babies born with no eyes.
That's Chief Chilhokpot. Maura, that sounds quite troubling. What role, if any, are government or oil companies playing in addressing or even acknowledging the pollution and the effects it's having on the community? Because these are very serious effects we're talking about.
The country has the national environmental law, and luckily they had carried out a long-awaited environmental audit, and its finding is still overdue. We're waiting to know exactly what are the findings from that environmental audit, and also some of the members from the Council of States. They did some workshops about the compensation to the communities and also the oil effects on the communities. But still, we are hanging here and we're waiting to hear from the government. I'm waiting also to know more about this environmental audit.
In your conversations with healthcare professionals, did they mention any potential solutions or steps that could be taken in the meantime to help mitigate the health effects linked to the pollution?
Unfortunately, they usually used to have records, and they share it with the state ministry, and also they forward it to the national government, but there are no any feedback. And also they mention about scattered records within different areas that are producing oil, because now the community normalizing birth defects. They just say it's God who made this, and they bury the babies. And it's unfortunate because some of them, they report to the hospital, and some of them, they don't report to the hospital.
Do we know how many people are affected by this?
It's a random figures, honestly. it's not really fixed in one file or fixed like you can find it ready and then you will know to tackle or mitigate those cases. They just hear and sometimes they see on social media people reporting like child being born with birth defects in those areas.
Maura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's the reporter Maura Ajak. And you can watch the full Africa Eye episode. It's called South Sudan's Poisoned Floods, A Climate Crisis Unfolds. It's on BBC Africa's YouTube channel. Or you can listen to the podcast, which is the same title, on BBC Sounds or your usual podcast app. By the way, Focus on Africa, the podcast, is also on YouTube. You know what to do. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Let's move to Niger in the Sahel now, where there's a tussle between a French nuclear fuel firm and the ruling military junta. Orano, the firm, announced that it was to stop uranium production in Niger, citing increasingly difficult operational issues and money matters. Before this, the junta had withdrawn permission for Orano to exploit Niger's vast uranium deposits at another site at Imouraren. I've been finding out exactly what's behind the bumpiness in the uranium production business in Niger. Ibrahim Yahya Ibrahim is the deputy project director for the Sahel at the International Crisis Group, and he gave some of the answers to some of my questions. Tell us about Orano wanting to shut down its production site in Arlit. Just tell us what's behind this, what's going on.
There are new problems, but there are also old problems that are related to this decision. Right now, what is the immediate cause of this, as Orano explained, is the difficulty to export the products that they have been producing over the past years. We know that since the coup happened in Niger in July 2023, there was a tension between Niger and Benin, which led to the closing of the border between the two countries. And that border is one of the passing points of most of the import and export in and out Niger. And the fact that the border was closed rendered the export of those, you know, uranium products very difficult for Orano. The second problem is that there is an exploitation permit to exploit one of the biggest uranium plants, which has not been put in place, but I think they have been, they negotiated it. The exploration has not started yet, but it is one of the biggest reserves in the world of uranium, which is called Imouraren, which the Nigerian government withdrew from Orano.
So you told us about the immediate problem, and that is the Benin border being closed. So that has an impact on just day-to-day operations and the product being shifted. Tell us a little bit more about Imouraren, which is the mining site that they were ordered out of earlier. Has that had a financial impact on them?
Financial impact, I'm not sure, but maybe the forecast of how the investment is going to evolve in Niger. And we have to know that this is not the first time that Niger has crisis with Orano over the Imouraren site. In early 2000s, Orano, at that time it was Areva, started under pressure. When Niger pressured the company, you know, they started to do some working around the exploitation of the site. But then quickly they suspended it based on the argument that the price of uranium has gone down and the site has become much less profitable for them now. And then in 2009, there was also another tension between the government and Areva at that time. And then they started also to work a little bit, and then they shut it down after the coup in 2010. And then now the Nigerian government has always been pressuring Areva then, or Orano now, to start that exploitation, because it is a site that was supposed to produce quite a bit of revenue for the government. But, you know, the French company was also looking at the profitability of that, particularly if the uranium price are low in the world. You know, bringing in more products will lead to the price plummeting even more. So there had been that discussion back and forth between the two. Without the Nigerian government has never succeeded to push to pressure in the French company to exploit it. But I think now, given the diplomatic situation between Niger and France, all the tensions that we know about, maybe the military regime thought that it is time to withdraw the permit and give it perhaps to other companies that may be interested.
Right. And we'll talk about the other companies representing other nations, Turkey and Russia, coming to mind immediately. But before we do that, let's talk about the Niger junta's decision to dispute Orano's plans to pull out. Why are they disputing? Why would they do this?
So there is the company that issued, it's a state-owned company, Sopamin, which is the one that issued the statement saying that they are shareholders together with Orano, and Orano did not give them a heads up before deciding to suspend. And they thought that this was not a good way to treat your partner. But also, they, I think, have some, you know, grievances in terms of selling of the uranium that's currently available and that has not been traded, more than 1,000 tons of uranium that is available currently. But this is not the Nigerian government that is issuing this statement. So that's why I am a bit careful to link it directly. If the Nigerian government wanted to dispute it, there are channels through which the Nigerian government can dispute that.
But the shareholder we're talking about is a state-owned company, right?
Yes, it is a state-owned company, but it's not the government of Niger that is issuing that statement.
Right, it's the company
Ministry
itself.
Of Mining. The Ministry of Mining, it's the company itself that is doing that. And it's invoking mainly, you know, internal issues in the way that they do things, so rather than, you know, big problem in the way that the state sees the operation in the mining industry. It's not that. That's why I tend to be a bit careful to associate directly the government to that.
I appreciate that. But I'm wondering, does the company actually operate with a great deal of autonomy from the government, whichever government it is, whether it's junta or whether it's a civilian government?
No, it is the head of the company is nominated by the government, and it is a state-owned company that responds directly to the government.
The reason why I was trying to assess that was because let's talk about the national interests of Turkey and Russia. The junta has made quite clear that it has a particular affinity to different countries, different alliances and allegiances to what pertained previously in Niger. So I'm just wondering, they've had discussions, haven't they, Turkey and Russia, to discuss uranium operations. What can you tell us about that? And how much of a bearing does it have on the situation now?
Actually, honestly, we don't know if there have been discussion about this particular mining site, which is either Imuraren or, you know, the Somayir site. I would doubt it that the government would just withdraw the mine in Somayir and just give it away to another company, you know, another country. I think there's a lot of laws, a lot of legal dimensions to that, that will make such a move pretty difficult. And I believe that there are other opportunities for Russian companies or Turkish companies to invest in mining in Niger, including uranium mining in Niger. Those are not the only sites. Niger is well known as one of the biggest reserve of uranium in the world. So I would assume that this is what the government actually wanted. It wanted to diversify the partnership that they have with other countries that are interested in mines. And it is a good news if Turkey and Russia want to do that. But I don't think taking away mines that are owned by a French company like Orano and giving it away is the way that they would like to do it, rather than inviting companies from those two countries to invest in other mining sites.
What do you think is going to happen next with this site and the decision by the French company to withdraw? Will they reach an agreement with the Nigerian state-owned company, or is it going to simmer on for a while longer?
It's difficult to forecast. We know that this is all linked to the, as I mentioned, the diplomatic situation between Niger and France. Tensions between Niger and the French mining company is not new, it's old, but it's always been sorted out. But either diplomatically, you know, between the French government and the Nigerian government, there will be some negotiations. What is different now is the diplomatic channels through which those two parties used to sort out things is currently shut down. So we really don't know whether this is going to find a quick, you know, settlement between the two parties, or it is going to drag on until we see some renewed relationship between the two parties. I don't know, but I will doubt it that this is the end of it, you know, that the Nigerian government will let Orano go, etc. I do believe that they have quite a bit of investment in the country, and there are also other looming issues including, you know, the fact that this exploitation over half of a century has left quite a bit of damage, environmental damage in the region. And there have been discussion about how to repair some of the damages. I'm talking about pollution of groundwater, etc. And communities at the local level have been raising those issues. And I believe that the government would like to maintain the relationship so that at least to pressure the French company to make some investment in that too. But also there is a production that is already there. Currently, I talked about over 1,000 tons of uranium that is there, that is waiting to be exported. I am sure that there will be discussions about that. You know, the Nigerian government is also trying to reform the mining sector, which is a big issue right now, a big thing that they are putting. It is very popular because a lot of people believe, rightfully or wrongfully, that the mining sector is not producing as much revenue, and that there are companies that are exploiting Niger, particularly in terms of uranium, that are not giving the country its right share. So there are all those discussions that are also in the background of all of this.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
All right then. Bye-bye. That's Ibrahim Yahya Ibrahim, Deputy Project Director, responsible for the Sahel at the International Crisis Group based in Dakar. Focus on Africa was put together by Patricia Whitehorn, Bella Hassan and Joseph Keane in London. Paul Bachibenga was the senior producer. Jonathan Greer was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. Before I go, a reminder that our sister podcast, Africa Daily, is talking to Martha Koome, the first woman to become Chief Justice in Kenya. Alan Kasuja has been hearing about her plans to roll out special courts to deal with gender-based violence in Kenya. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.